been stabbed twice. It comes with the territory.
Just citing the obvious.
Nate, just chill out, man. Just chill out.
Hey, you're listening to Hack. I'm Sophie McNeil. Children being placed on tanks and used as human shields, or worse still, tortured to death. I'm talking about Syria, where the UN Special Representative for Children says there's never been such terrible atrocities committed against kids, and that the Syrian government is now one of the world's worst human rights offenders. In previous conflicts, in Rwanda and the Balkans, the world said if only we'd known, we would have done something to stop it. So what's the excuse now that war is live on YouTube? And the latest horrors are just one click away, only hours after they happen. Plus, where Facebook is being accused of fueling ethnic conflict and contributing to deaths. It's all part of a special discussion on social media and more today on Hack. Stay tuned. Overnight, the UN declared that what's happening in Syria is now classified as a full-scale civil war. The majority of the information we're getting out of the country is often from social media, as it's too dangerous for the Western media to get the news themselves. Syrians have been tweeting, YouTubing and Facebooking since the conflict began. And now even the UN observers in Syria have their own YouTube channel to upload the latest horror. So what do you think about how social media has changed the way you follow a conflict? Do you feel more empowered now that we know what's going on? Or do you just feel guilty and frustrated that now we know, but no one is doing anything about it? Give me a call, 1300 055 536. That's 1300 055 536. Or send us a text, 0439 757 555. First, we send Hack's Julia Holman off to war without her even having to leave her computer.
Three men are standing outside their home. It's been bombed, and as you can hear, they're devastated.
Four boys dead. Four.
Say that again?
The video was shot 2 days ago in the city of Homs. It wasn't shot by a news crew or by a citizen journalist, but by observers from the United Nations. They've uploaded the clip to their YouTube channel, and it's part of their social media strategy to get you informed about what's happening in Syria. Syria's a real mess, and the United Nations have said that it's in civil war. This week, the UN Special Representative for Children and Armed Conflict says that even children are being targeted.
I have never seen such terrible action against children. We have cases of children really being things that usually do not happen in conflict areas, where children get killed in the crossfire, but actually torturing children or putting children on tanks and using them as human shields. These are things, and or summarily executing children. These are things that normally don't happen in warfare.
That wasn't a surprise to 19-year-old Sydneysider Basma Cahill.
They've just been killing the people and torturing them, kidnapping them, raping them, whatever they can do just to scare them.
Basma's family is from Homs, and she and her family get most of their information when they sit in their living room watching clips from Syria on YouTube.
There's a constant update, like every 4 to 5 minutes you find another 3 videos. I don't really watch the news because I don't trust the news in general, so I stick to YouTube most of the time.
And the things that she's seen could turn anyone's stomach.
There was one video that I saw. It was a boy, or it was a guy, he was a teenager, and half his face was blown off and he was still alive. And you can hear him in the video, he's like crying, but he can't talk because there's nothing there to articulate the sounds. So he's just wailing, and yeah, that's all he was able to do. And that's just like one of the many, many videos that we see coming up. And it's just very frustrating. And the other videos where you find babies have been slaughtered or that people have been buried under their houses because a bomb came to their house.
In the past, governments and international bodies said they didn't act because they didn't know enough. But you'd have to say that this is one conflict where ignorance is not an excuse.
Particularly around the Arab Spring, you've got this kind of 360-degree sense of what's happening. And I think that has changed some of the perceptions, or it's allowed some of these conflicts to stay on the radar perhaps longer than they would have done previously.
Claire Wardle works for Storyful, which is a social media news agency. She says that platforms like Facebook and Twitter are really changing the ways that we find out about war zones.
Particularly some of the earlier footage from Syria, where you were seeing families live tweeting from their living rooms as they were being bombed or as they were being attacked. And you were seeing these living rooms and thinking, hang on, this is a place like Syria that I've never been to. And in your head, you have a kind of idea of what that might be like. But they're sitting in a living room that looks like your living room. And you suddenly go, hang on, this isn't what I expected. And it suddenly resonates in a way that some of these conflicts from overseas, you've only ever seen in 2.5 minute packages at the 6 o'clock bulletin, and you don't really get the wider context, and you get the correspondent standing there with their microphone telling you something, but you don't get a sense of the country.
But is the public pressure from social media strong enough to change the way that world leaders act? The UN Special Envoy says not yet.
The longer this violence continues, the more dangerous it becomes for not only the country and the Syrian people, but the region, and the sectarian nature that is emerging, it's dangerous. And the red light is flashing.
Basma Cahill says that when the violence began, she actually became addicted to YouTube.
Every single day, you'd find me hours on YouTube just watching the videos.
But she's frustrated because she feels like there's been little done to stop it.
I've decreased it a lot because I've been getting very frustrated and fired up, and nothing's been happening. So just to calm my frustration, I haven't been watching it, because the more I watch, the more I get angry.
While the violence is likely to continue for some time, at least social media can demonstrate, albeit in graphic detail, the human cost.
We are people. Nobody help us. Why? We are people, not animal. We not animal. We are people.
Hacks, Julia Holman reporting there. So how does this make us feel about the world? Does it make us feel more empowered that we know what's going on? Or does it just make us feel a little bit guilty and frustrated that now we know, but no one's really doing anything about it? Give me a call, 1300 055 536. That's 1300 055 536. Or send us a text, 0439 757 555. I've already got a few texts here. Someone says, it's always been like this. We just have the inside view now. And Ellie from Melbourne says, I can't handle watching footage of what is happening in Syria. It brings me to tears just hearing of it. It's very disturbing and frustrating. The world must act to stop this immediately. Now, joining me in the Hack studio to discuss this is Anthony Lowenstein. He's a Sydney-based journalist and blogger who's written extensively about social media in the Middle East on his blog and in his book, The Blogging Revolution. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. Now, you've followed the evolution of new media and war in recent years. What's your response to this? Is it more empowering for us sitting here watching, or should we just feel guilty?
Well, the simple answer is both. I think what you're seeing is, of course, in the last years, the Arab Spring, even the parts of the Iraq War, the Afghan War, we can find out far more, either through people on the ground or elsewhere, what's actually happening. But at the same time, the danger, I think, is the sense of clicktivism, where an activist or an individual in Sydney, Melbourne, somewhere so far away from the conflict, feels like they can maybe do something by signing a petition. But actually, the question is, what is that petition actually calling for, and how effective is that actually in changing the situation on the ground?
It's true. There is a lot of talk of clicktivism, especially after the Kony 2012 campaign
Yes.
that we had earlier this year. But it's pretty amazing, isn't it, how much war has changed. And now you've got these UN observers on the ground. They're there investigating atrocities. And within a few hours of them witnessing something, they put it up on their own YouTube channel.
I think it's fascinating, and it's certainly a wonderful new tool. I mean, the truth is, in Syria, as many listeners will know, journalists generally can't get in there. It's too dangerous. The government doesn't allow them to get in there. Western journalists I'm talking about. So we have to really rely particularly on mainly rebels or those opposed to Assad, the president. So, yes, there's no doubt that those kind of voices are important. And you see that in lots of war zones, and including, I might add, individuals who maybe fight for sides we don't agree with as well, using the internet to put out their message as well.
How does it change the way that governments respond or are forced to respond, Anthony? I mean, well, maybe they always knew about what went on, you know, in places like Rwanda. But I guess now they don't have an excuse because we find out things the same time that they do. Is that what's changed?
I think in some ways what's happening in Syria and places like that really is still global power politics, that in some ways the conflict in Syria has become a proxy war between the US and Iran. It's a complex mix. And after the Arab Spring, of course, the US is desperate in some ways to have more friends in the Middle East after the potential of certain leaders who are friendly to them falling. But I think what it does do is it potentially puts more pressure on governments to do something. The question is, of course, what to do. And I think there's a danger, as we've seen in many examples in the last 10 years, of using US military means, aerial bombardments or ground forces, to actually try and affect change for the better. And you've seen this in Iraq, Afghanistan, arguably Libya, where the situation really has become far more problematic because of US military intervention.
Someone's texted in and said, can anyone blame the West for not getting involved after the reaction to Iraq and Afghanistan?
It's true.
Yeah, I've got Jules here. Jules, what's your opinion on the way we view war has changed?
Look, I mean, I think what you've said about, you know, the fact that we know everything as it happens is certainly true. But I think ultimately we need to be honest about what social media can and can't do and the way it empowers young people, particularly with respect to conflict. I mean, you spoke about Kony 2012. I think that unfortunately promotes a view, you know, that young people in social media only promote very superficial engagement with armed conflict. I mean, that, you know, campaign rapidly, rather than promoting awareness of an issue, instead became a parody. But I think, you know, we can also see there are examples where, you know, you use social media to engage young people with conflict issues in a very positive way. So I think it really does depend on how you use it. And certainly it has a potential to be a very great tool for empowerment, but also ultimately to become, unfortunately, an issue for parody. So, yeah.
Thanks for the call, Jules. I've got Anton here. Anton, what's your opinion about the way the social media war is being fought on Syria?
My opinion is that you really can't trust a lot of these videos that come up on Facebook and on YouTube. How do you know they're not footage from a completely different war or from a completely different time? There's no legitimacy to it, and there's no way of verifying that it's real.
Anton, you're cutting out a bit there. Are you still there, mate?
Yeah, I'm here.
Are you? I noticed you're from Syria. Your family's from Syria.
Northern Lebanon, actually.
Northern Lebanon, okay. So do you support the Assad regime? Because I know there's a lot of arguments over these videos, but the UN has come out and said that, you know, atrocities are being committed. But when you see videos because you support the Syrian government, is that what makes you suspicious?
It's not that I support the Syrian government. I have family members that support the Syrian government, and I'm from a region in Lebanon where a lot of the Islamic people up there do support it. I personally don't support it. I just question the legitimacy of the videos that come up both ways.
True. Thanks for the call, Anton. And Anthony, this is definitely something that journalists need to be very careful about, how you verify these videos.
Absolutely. And you've seen this, in fact, in many examples in Egypt and elsewhere where the legitimacy or the accuracy is questioned. I think there's still a role, though, for journalists. And I'm not going to say journalists are objective. The truth is, in many conflicts, journalists, by definition, are going to either take sides. But we shouldn't also forget that in Syria, the narrative that I think social media is creating is a bit inaccurate, that it's almost like Assad bad, rebels good. And I think, not that I'm defending the Assad regime, they're brutal thugs. There's no question about that, but there's lots of evidence to suggest that the rebels as well are committing crimes. And just last week, a British Channel 4 TV journalist came out and said that, in fact, he had hard evidence, because it happened to him personally, of the rebels trying to get him killed by the regime to prove how bad the regime is. So it's far too simple, I think, to simply see this as good versus evil.
True. Nothing is often ever that simple. Jason, what do you think?
Hello.
Hey, Jason, what do you think about this?
Well, basically, bottom line is I'm a firm believer that the UN and all the governments around the world, especially the US, aren't going to intervene if there's nothing for them to gain, i.e. lithium, oil, etc. In Libya, the Americans, or the UN, they were in straight away, weren't they?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Bombing everyone, killing everyone, whatever. But that's because there was oil. There's a large oil supply in Libya.
Thanks for the call. What do you think of that point, Anthony, that the reason the West hasn't intervened so far in Syria is because there is no great strategic kind of purpose behind it? What do you think of that?
I think it's definitely a strategic benefit in terms of actual resources. Syria hasn't got very much, as your last caller just said. If Libya's main export was lettuce, rest assured the West wouldn't have gone in there. So, yes, there's definitely an issue, I think, with the way that Syria is viewed. As I said, Syria's become a proxy war in a way. It's not just simply Assad versus rebels. It's become also a war between elements in the Gulf. I just read tonight, in fact, that Saudi Arabia and Qatar are now funding and arming the rebels against the regime because they see the fall of the Assad regime is a way to get more power in the Middle East against the rise of Iran. Of course, the rise of Iran has massively happened because of the US invasion of Iraq in the last 10 years. So, yes, Syria is definitely become a proxy war. Whether the US militarily intervenes, personally, I believe they should not. What should happen, though, of course, is really up to, in some ways, the global powers. In the Security Council, it's hard to see China or Russia supporting any serious military intervention, for better or worse.
And why do the Russians and the Chinese continue to give weapons to the Syrian government?
I guess you could argue, why do the Americans give weapons to the Bahraini regime? I mean, the argument somehow that China and Russia are giving weapons to a bad regime, they are doing that.
Well, the UN, has been very critical. I mean, there are stories about the rebels, but I think that the majority of the information coming out from the UN is that the Syrian government has been committing a lot of atrocities.
Indeed.
So I think, there is, and the UN Security Council has been calling on Russia and China to stop arming the government. So, I mean, obviously it's strategic why they arm them.
I think it is that, and I think it's also a sense that China and Russia, both with their own internal issues in terms of insurgencies, don't want to set an example of outside intervention. Of course, China has, for example, issues with Muslim minority and also Tibet, and Russia has many areas which they don't particularly like Moscow. So this is also partly a domestic question, but also an international question, ultimately.
Danny, you work for an NGO. How does social media help you do your job?
Yeah, so social media, I actually just started the job a few months ago, and one of my roles is actually to go into schools and actually raise the awareness of not just issues over in Eastern Asia, which is where we majority operate, but actually to raise this awareness and see that children can be saved out of this type of slavery. The area that we actually focus on in Eastern Asia is mainly Thailand and Cambodia, and rescuing children as young as 8 from sexual slavery, which is just huge. These children have been sold into brothels, and the way that social media has actually helped in the sense is, like a talker said just before, a caller, that you can either use it for good or for bad. So the way that it's helped us has just been a huge awareness, and people are getting on board and they're saying, look, what can we do about it? How can we make a change? And actually, if you're on a Facebook site, you can see that the age group that's majority, the main age group that's actually really getting behind this issue is 18 to 24.
Mm-hmm.
So if we look at... Yeah.
I was going to say, thanks so much for the call, Danny. It's a really interesting point, and it's great to hear how it affects you personally in the work you do. And I just want to come back to you quickly just to finish. I mean, how does this change the role of what journalists do? We just heard there that Danny's getting the word out on stories through his NGO work and social media. Have journalists become a bit redundant now? You've got NGO workers, activists, UN observers on the ground posting videos and getting the story out. What's the role for journalists?
I think the journalist role is still important. I mean, obviously, if the rebels in Syria put out footage, there should be at least an ability to try and see if it's accurate or not, as much as that's possible or not. But no, I think journalists have a role. But what's also happening now, of course, the democratization of information. So there's a much easier ability for journalists and others to also be journalists. And also it shows that in many cases, corporate media often doesn't actually do a particularly good job in reporting conflict. And what it does do, just finally, is that in many areas, the Western media still refuses to actually put the voices on of locals as opposed to a journalist himself or herself going to a place. There seems to be a degree of mistrust of local people speaking in their own voices.
Anthony Lowenstein, a Sydney-based author and blogger who's written extensively about social media in the Middle East. Thanks so much for joining us on Hack.
Thanks for having me.
We've got a few texts here. Tim from Bondi says, why should we feel guilty? We have nothing to do with this. Someone else says, how many times do we have to fix a country? In 5 to 10 years, the same stuff will just happen. Let them sort themselves out, and who knows, it might be for the better.
It's hard to describe. It's like
madness. It was just madness in our house. Sex, drugs and rock and roll.
Hack. You are listening to Hack on Triple J. I'm Sophie McNeil. Today, the head of NATO praised Australia's efforts in making the world a safer place. He said our contribution to war in Afghanistan is outstanding. But a prominent Australian human rights activist disagrees. His name is Phil Glendening and he's from the Edmund Rice Centre. He's just returned from Afghanistan, where he was tracking down more than 30 failed asylum seekers. Glendening claims that two of the returnees have been killed, that one was kidnapped and is presumed dead. He's launching his report on the findings from his recent trip tonight in Sydney, and I spoke to him earlier.
Well, Shahid Ahmadi was shot in his home district up near Wardak province. And
why?
Well, basically, when he got back, he discovered that a combination of Taliban and Kuchi, which is a nomadic group, had taken over his land. And they saw him as a threat, having left and gone to the West. And therefore, he must be sympathetic to the West. He maybe was involved with the Western forces. Mm. So he was shot dead. Mohammed Hussain, which was a case I was particularly close to because I'd met him on a previous visit. And he was kidnapped and was held in detention for about 9 months by Taliban insurgents. He escaped and went over the border into Iran. And he was arrested there, sent back into Afghanistan, contacted me to say that he was in great danger and could we let Australians or Americans know that the Taliban, he believed, were coming for him. He was kidnapped not long after that again and was taken down to his home village and in front of 35 members of his family, thrown down a well, and a hand grenade was thrown in after him and it blew his head straight off his head. Of his shoulders. So the bottom line here is when he came to this country and he was out on Nauru and he told Australian officials and international officials, if you send me back, this will happen. And, you know, it's precisely what did happen. And what's actually happened in this debate at the moment in the country politically, and I don't blame the department, I very much blame the politicians here. What's been lost in all of this, in this divisive issue, is behind the policy, behind the politics, behind the heat, are the lives of real people.
Why were these men who ended up being killed once they were sent back to Afghanistan, why were they sent back?
Well, their stories weren't believed and they were found that they didn't have a well-founded fear of persecution. Now, if correct decisions are made and people can be safely removed, well, that's a good process and I certainly don't advocate open border policy under no circumstances. But if people come here and for reasons unbeknownst to us, particularly when in Nauru, when there was absolutely no form of any appeal, no form of review, no habeas corpus in lots of ways, that people were sent back, often given a form that wasn't signed, that was a box was ticked, you haven't proved that your case is well-founded, and were sent back. And then when they go back, they discover that they're facing the very same risk that they faced when they left, but increased because they've left. When you make mistakes in this area, people die.
You also heard the story of a 17-year-old who'd been sent back, who'd come here to Australia, claimed asylum, failed in that application and was sent back. What happened to him?
Well, this report came from Ashiana, which is the largest NGO in Afghanistan, who reported to us that they'd found a young guy on the streets, 17, last October, that he was homeless and he was ill. And he claims that he'd been in Australia and was sent back via Turkey to Istanbul. Now, we've yet to confirm that, and certainly that's one of the issues that we're looking into very deeply.
If people are found not to be refugees, why shouldn't they be sent back to Afghanistan? I mean, it is where they're from and it is a dangerous place, but if something happens to them, does it really mean the Australian government made the wrong call?
If they're killed for the reasons that they sought asylum, absolutely. If they get hit by a bus crossing the road or if they get involved in some criminal activity that's outside a convention reason, well, no, you're right. And if people are found not to have valid claims, of course they should be removed, but they need to be removed to somewhere of safety.
Phil, Nauru is still talked about as a solution to processing asylum seekers. The opposition is committed to it. They want to reopen Nauru if they get elected. Do you think that if Nauru is reopened, similar problems could occur with people being sent back and being killed?
Yeah, absolutely. I sat with a family the other day who had a birth certificate of a child that was born in Nauru, wondering what the status of that baby still is. On Nauru, there was no way that people could appeal a decision. That was it. You're out, you're gone. The second thing is, I mean, Nauru is a terribly, terribly poor country. It needs a lot of assistance in development and, you know, appropriate aid and support.
That's Phil Glendenning from the Edmund Rice Centre in Sydney. Now, a spokesperson from the Department of Immigration told HAC that the department takes such allegations seriously, and if specific information can be provided, the department will gladly investigate. And that as a signatory to the Refugee Convention, the government is committed to proper and robust assessment of asylum claims.
You're listening to HAC with Sophie McNeil.
Now, we heard earlier about how social media can help spread word of a conflict and let people know what's going on. But can it also help fuel a conflict? Is it concerning that it not only informs but can be used to inflame hatred? Well, this apparently is what's happening in Burma. After a string of ethnic attacks in the far western district of the country, hatred towards the country's Rohingya Muslim community is building. They've been blamed for the attacks and the nation's media is jumping on board. On Facebook and Twitter, Muslims are openly referred to as terrorists and are given racial slurs, and thousands are calling for their death. And a warning, there's a bit of language in this story. Alex Mann reports.
It's tit-for-tat ethnic violence that seems a long way from ending.
This has been a flare-up of violence, the likes of which we haven't seen. My name's Dr. Nicholas Farrelly. I'm a research fellow in the College of Asia and the Pacific at the Australian National University in Canberra. I think we've all got to be very worried when we see incidents like those that have emerged in westernmost Burma over the past 10 days or so.
But the facts are difficult to verify when both sides claim victim status and the nation's newly opened online media starts to take sides.
Over the past few days, there has been an unprecedented storm of such rhetoric. Much of it is of the most reactionary sort. I think you could probably fairly describe this as a hurricane of hate.
Things turned serious just 10 days ago when a mob of 300 Buddhists from the western Burmese state of Rakhine stopped a bus and beat to death 11 people travelling to Yangon. 10 were Muslim, another was Buddhist and mistaken for a Muslim. Attackers say it was payback for the rape murder of a 26-year-old Rakhine woman, allegedly by 3 Muslim men, and since then the retaliation of violence has continued. Burma-based NGOs are reporting houses of Rohingya families being burnt and between 200 to 300 deaths. The numbers are very difficult to verify. Burma is predominantly Buddhist, while Rakhine State is home to the country's largest Muslim population, a group subjected to nationwide resentment. The worst is kept for the Rohingyas, whose roots date back to the 19th century when they were brought to the country as labourers by colonial power Britain. And while the escalating violence is worrying, the tenor of public debate across the country has run wild.
It's the Rohingya terrorists that fired the villages and killed Burmese people.
We do not want them. They destroy our nation. Kill and eat them. To hell with Muslim people.
Wash your mouths with pig shit. Fuck all Muslims.
Such comments and postings have been littered on thousands of Facebook walls and pages, with groups like Kalar Beheading Gang springing up one after another, with the nation's media now regularly labelling Muslims as terrorists and even using the racist slur Kalar to describe the country's persecuted Muslim population. Nicholas Farrelly says Burma's newfound media freedoms may be fueling the violence.
Certainly the internet provides opportunities for those elsewhere inside Burma, but also right around the world, to play some role in stoking these political fires. What we're seeing right now is, I think, a very unhelpful dynamic which reinforces itself hour by hour, day by day, as furious cyber mobs become ever more motivated in their vitriol and in their efforts to target those who they see as not fitting in to their understanding of what Burma is and who actually belongs.
One guy feeling the heat is Myo Win. He's a Burmese Muslim and he's based in Yangon. He's also the head of the research department for the Islamic Institute of Myanmar. Myo Win says the way the media has reported the violence has made things much worse.
It is very, terrible. These medias are not neutral. Most of the media in Burma, they didn't follow the ethical media in Burma just now. That is real main problem.
So, Myo Win, are you afraid that ethnic cleansing might happen in Rakhine and that there might be attacks on Muslims in other states of Burma?
Yes, we are people in Muslim people, especially for the all Muslim people, are worrying day by day. That is really genocide and Holocaust for those Muslim people, not only in Rakhine State. They are studying from the Rakhine State now. They are now continuing to the other state too.
Nicholas Farrelly says this violence is a warning sign and the international community should be paying close attention.
The sorts of conditions perhaps that have been seen in countries like Kosovo and Rwanda in decades past are the sorts of conditions that the international community needs to be paying very close attention to. And I'm sure there are many who wonder whether some intervention or some smart interaction with a conflict or pre-conflict situation in those cases would have provided some alternative outcome.
I'm sorry, that's all we have time for tonight. Thanks for listening and thanks for all your Facebook comments and your texts. Linda's up next with Good Nights and we'll catch you tomorrow. See ya.